So what we'd like to do is say not only there, as we can say now, that there definitely was nanothermite materials at the World Trade Center. They are without a doubt scattered throughout the World Trade Center dust. But we are in the process of pinpointing exactly what formulations, which will help us determine who had access to those exact formulations or who developed those formulations. And as I said in a couple of other interviews and in some of my papers, you know, the reasoning for that is my view is that we take an intersection between those who had access to the technologies and get as exact as we can, and those who had access to the buildings. So we have certain companies like Kroll and Securicom and various people who were involved with updating the security of the buildings, the various tenants that were present on the floors of impact and failure or apparent failure. And then we look at the people who, the third part of the intersection is the cover-up itself. So we have three groups there, those people who cleaned up the evidence at World Trade Center. And many people may know that that the evidence, the, particularly the steel evidence at the World Trade Center, was whisked away in an unprecedented sort of manner, and that was really uncalled for. And there was a lot of strong criticism of that. So the people who cleaned up were part of the cover-up to some extent. At least some of them must have been. The people who wrote these official reports, clearly false reports, repeatedly false, multiple false reports, and the same people involved in the multiple false reports. Those are people who were involved in a cover-up. And then finally, there are some people that who are persistently called debunkers, who I would also take a close look at in terms of why they would be so motivated to cover up what happened on September 11th. So there's a three-way intersection, who had access to the technologies, who had access to the buildings, and who was involved in the cover-up. I think if we look closely at the intersection of those three groups, we'll get very close to, if not identify exactly, the people who were responsible for what happened at the World Trade Center.
Sure, and this is part of what I love about your work is that you have literally jumped in with both feet. You're naming names. I hope we can come back to this later in this this conversation, Kevin. But I want to go back to the red chips, and ever since Dr. Jones has been doing his fine work on the dust when he got samples sent to him, we have consistently found evidence which would refute the official story and support this idea that there was something else going on there. Now, the red chips, do you hypothesize that they are actually a product of this nanothermite reaction, or that they were actually unexploded ordnance?
Yes, they are unexploded. They're unignited materials. Now, they may also be partially ignited. And the reason I say that is that when I make nanothermites, I've made a couple of different formulations, and one looks very much like the red chips. In the color and appearance, it looks just the unignited material. On the other hand, another one, when ignited, forms reddish type of like partially reacted chips. So they do appear to be not fully ignited material. So they're active. They can be ignited. We've actually done that as well, not only in the differential scanning calorimeter that I explained, but also in this paper you'll see that we've ignited the materials directly. So taking a, like an acetylene torch and ignited these red chips directly and seen the metallic spheres form there, seen the exothermic reaction there. And that experiment has been done in more than one laboratory. It's been done in a couple of laboratories. And so clearly these red chips are unignited material, or you could say at least not fully ignited material.
Now, as time has gone on and this research has been done, I think maybe it might have been Dr. Jones who first uncovered the fact that much of the evidence which he has discovered in the dust was already discovered, some of it by the U.S. Geological Survey. And then as well, the company R.J. Lee had discovered many of these same things, which included the microspheres, the different things that we have found that would indicate extremely high temperatures. Yet they went ahead and kind of glossed over them, saying they admitted there were high temperatures, but didn't explain it. Now, I guess I'm curious, were these red chips found by anybody else before Dr. Jones found them?
No, we haven't. Well, at least not reported. I believe Dr. Jones first reported those in the summer of 2007. So he's been on the trail of these red chips for a while. I know that he publicly announced the finding in Boston in December of 2007. I was there with him when he started publicly speaking about these red chips. And as far as that goes, no, I haven't seen announcements from other researchers of having found these materials. I don't know how many other, whether the USGS or R.J. Lee took the time to look at the magnetic fraction as carefully as we have. The reason we started looking at the magnetic fraction, of course, was because of the large number of iron-rich spheres, microspheres. Now, those other groups did find the not only iron-rich, but the USGS found molybdenum-rich spheres. Now, that speaks to a much higher temperature required for molten molybdenum to form spheres. But also R.J. Lee found the spheres, and also the EPA mentioned in one of their early reports that they were considering the iron-rich spheres as a signature component for World Trade Center dust. Now, they decided against using that or publicizing that in a later paper. They didn't really say why. The EPA didn't really say, well, because of this reason, we decided not to use it any longer as a characteristic feature. But the iron-rich spheres have been found by many groups, and it's the red chips that are the new and revelatory sort of finding.
And we have with us on the line Kevin Ryan, formerly of Underwriters Laboratories, and fired for asking too many questions about what happened on September 11th, 2001, down at Ground Zero. We've been talking about the discoveries that he and others, including Dr. Jones and many others, have found in the dust from the collapses of the three high-rises there on September 11th, which include an abundance of these metallic microspheres. We've talked about that on this show before with Dr. Jones. And more recently, the red-gray bilayered chips, which have been discovered and have been ongoing, an investigation through the Citizens 9/11 investigation to determine the nature and composition of these chips. When you folks read this new paper that's coming out, which is titled Active Thermitic Material Discovered in Dust from the 9/11 World Trade Center Catastrophe, I think that you will be equally stunned as I am and others at the sheer volume of the physical evidence, which would suggest that nanothermites were used in the destruction of the Twin Towers. And it's unbelievable to me that despite the NFPA 921 mandate, along with the experience that the actual NIST investigators had with explosive thermite materials, together with witness testimony and literally common sense, that these buildings were actually brought down. They had much aid in their destruction. Now, Kevin, one of the things that you have done and that you did indeed do in your paper, The Top 10 Connections Between NIST and Nanothermites, is you identify some of the individuals, the organizations who are involved in the NIST investigation, along with tremendous knowledge of this new technology known as nanotechnology. I wonder if we could get into some of these folks that you have actually discovered.
Sure. There's a company that I'm very interested in called Science Applications International, or it's also called SAIC. Now, they're a Department of Defense contractor, Homeland Security contractor, and they were the largest supplier of non-government investigators to the NIST investigation. If you look at the NIST reports, there's a very long list of these SAIC investigators that were involved. And they have extensive links to nanothermites. They develop nanothermites, and they're the ones that judge nanothermite research proposals, and they also have a company, a subsidiary called Applied Ordnance, that's done a lot of research on ignition of nanothermites with lasers and so forth. So SAIC is of great interest to me. They're also a company that formerly employed people that are, I think, somewhat suspect in what happened on 9/11. Jerome Hauer is the name of a man who used to work for SAIC, and the reason he's interesting is that he also was working for Rudy Giuliani in Rudy's Office of Emergency Management, and he was on television on September 11th pretty much giving us the official story, that although the official story didn't come out for years afterward, Jerome Hauer was giving us the official story on the day of 9/11, very calmly on network television. Another employee of SAIC is Stephen Hatfield, who was, at least for a while, implicated in the anthrax attacks. So some interesting employees and connections to SAIC, but the SAIC definitely has great expertise in nanothermites. Another person I'm very interested in is John Layman. He was a 9/11 commissioner, and he was also involved in an incident back in the 80s and 90s called the Tailhook Scandal, which was Navy sort of a scandal that involved the abuse of women and money, and I think pointed to the fact that some of our 9/11 commissioners are not the upstanding citizens that maybe we thought they were. But John Layman purchased an explosives company called Special Devices in 1998, and Special Devices is a company that makes not only thermitic-type materials, but also typical explosives used for spacecraft and other mining, other purposes like that. And so it was interesting to find out that John Layman, a 9/11 commissioner who created the report that told us that, Al-Qaeda was out to get us, but it couldn't possibly have involved in any government agencies. John Layman also owned this explosive company that could very well have been involved, as far as I know. It's theoretical, of course, but they certainly could have created a number of these materials. And since John Layman was also the Secretary of the Navy, I'm interested in how he might be connected to the Naval Surface Warfare Center at Indian Head in Maryland, because that place was the first sort of high-production facility for the production of nanoaluminum. Now, nanoaluminum is the really difficult thing to manufacture in nanothermites. I can actually make nanothermites once I have the nanoaluminum. I can make the salt gel type, but I can't make the nanoaluminum. That's a very high-tech, and Richard Gaze has pointed out many times that it's not made in a cave in Afghanistan, and I think we can be pretty certain of that. So the Naval Surface Warfare Center at Indian Head in Maryland is high on my list of interesting organizations. And they hired in 1999 a number of very interesting contractors at this Naval Surface Warfare Center. They hired SAIC, in fact, in 1999. They hired Applied Ordnance, SAIC's subsidiary. They hired Battelle, the laboratory management group that's connected to Arden Beament, the NIST director, and also was connected to the anthrax attacks because Battelle managed Fort Detrick. The Naval Surface Warfare Center also contracted with Booz Allen Hamilton, interesting sort of CIA-type organization, Mantech, Richard Armitage's company, Titan, James Woolsey's company, and Pacific Scientific Energetics was another company that NSWC hired, and that's the parent company for special devices that John Layman was involved with. So if you read this paper, I think you'll see that there's quite a number of compelling connections between all these groups that had explosive capabilities and their connections to the NIST and 9/11 Commission. And I think it's just the tip of the iceberg, and we've got an ongoing investigation, a number of us, into what companies were involved at the World Trade Center that we know for sure might have had some involvement.
I also found that the people involved in the cover-up are also representative in the form of Foreman Williams.
Oh, yeah, Foreman Williams. I mentioned Foreman Williams is was the lead engineer on the NIST Advisory Committee. He was also the leading expert for Popular Mechanics in
That's
their
it,
debunking
yeah. mm-hmm.
debunking book. Popular Mechanics really had very few experts. If you look through their list in the back, there were a couple of engineers. Foreman Williams was one of them, and he is the author of several papers on energetic materials that are labeled the ignition of porous energetic materials. So exactly the kinds of materials we're talking about. Nanothermites are porous energetic materials. And, you know, his other associates are also people who are experts in nanoenergetics, and we can see that from the conferences they presented at. So Foreman Williams, definitely. Richard Gann is the guy who edited the NIST report on the towers, and he was doing a project back in the 90s with some of the experts, some of whose names I can't even pronounce, some of the experts on nanothermites, and how they related to fire suppression, unique fire suppression materials. So that leads us into a hypothesis that I think has got very strong merit, and that is that somehow the upgrades to the fireproofing that were done in the World Trade Center buildings, particularly in the towers in 1999 and 2000, were somehow related to the installation of these explosive materials. So, you know, the reasons that those ideas seem feasible are that the nanothermites can be sprayed on. The exact types that we're talking about, sol gel nanothermites, are used as coatings, and they're even spelled out that in the Lawrence Livermore papers. But also, if you look at the floors that were impacted and the floors of fire on September 11th, I pointed out in a paper called Another Amazing Coincidence at the World Trade Center that these floors match up exactly with the floors that were upgraded for fireproofing.
Interesting.
And it's just astounding, really, and difficult to imagine how there couldn't be some sort of connection. So, you know, novel forms of fireproofing that are being developed along with in projects where experts in nanothermites are involved, that's very interesting to me. It's also very interesting that, you know, the elevators were upgraded in the year before September 11th. And I think Richard Gage has pointed this out many times. There's a company called Ace Elevator that was involved with that. Just so happens that the Ace Elevator technicians all went missing when the building started burning and exploding. So these are difficult subjects to talk about, but we really have to force our way through finding out what happened because of what 9/11 has been used for. And I think we all agree that looking at this collapse of the economy, that you know, all of that was expedited, if not created, by the official story of 9/11 and the wars that have ensued.
Indeed, indeed. Now, you mentioned that this thermitic material can be sprayed on. What would we expect if you took just a steel beam in an experiment, sprayed it with this stuff, and ignited it? What would it do?
Well, now it depends on the thickness, and it depends on the exact application. I've pointed out that it seems to me, along the wall, the perimeter walls of the World Trade Center, that it's very possible that thermitic materials, not only nanothermites, but typical micron or macro thermite materials, could have been loaded into the bolt holes of the exterior columns, and that would have caused a great deal of exothermic activity. But the floor pans, the floor decks, are where I'm most interested in the application of nanothermite. So the materials that I've made could easily be a coating. I've made them and coated them myself on in small quantities on steel coupons, and when ignited, they cause a great deal of fire and sparking and explosions. And so one possibility for the use of nanothermites in particular, and there are a couple of strong possibilities. One is that, they were used to create fire where fire would not have otherwise been. So why is that important? Because this is an operation that is based on deception. So in the World Trade Center towers, the fires would have otherwise been out very quickly, and even NIST admits that in any given area of the buildings, there was only about 20 minutes worth of fire load, typical office furnishings. But the fires burned quite a bit longer. They almost look like a controlled sort of burn. And I think that nanothermites could have been used to make that happen. But additionally, if you read this paper that we're putting out, then there are other purposes for nanothermites, including in the ignition of explosives. So I think I mentioned that SAIC had a lot of interest in the ignition of nanothermites by lasers, but nanothermites are used for various purposes, including by NASA, to ignite actual typical explosives. And
well, somewhat like the thermite matches?
Yeah, so like thermite matches. And so if that's what was done, that typical explosives were ignited using thermite matches, then the residue of the thermite matches could be what we're looking at. We could also be looking at, as I said before, the residue of materials that, or the unignited portion of materials that were part of a deceptive operation. So there's a couple of possibilities there for nanothermites.
Now, has anybody looked for evidence of some of these more traditional explosives?
We've been talking about it, but no. I think the best thing to do is to start testing for RDX, HMX, and those sorts of things in the World Trade Center dust. And
so would these traditional explosives, would they leave a fingerprint similar to like the chemical fingerprint for thermite that we find? Would these other explosives leave a similar fingerprint of their past existence there?
Yes, yes, they would. Typically, in the analytical techniques I've been involved with for RDX, they're just screening techniques. But there are more specific techniques that can be used, more specific analytical equipment can be used to determine the exact degradant products of RDX or HMX. And that's the next step that we're looking at now.
Well, I so appreciate the scientific approach. I know that for years when I first became involved in the movement, we were just working so hard to try to make people aware of what the questions that we had, and especially with regards to the Twin Towers, because many of us knew that there was something rotten in the state of Denmark, especially when Building 7 came down. But to have somebody like you, Kevin, and Dr. Jones, and many of the other scientists working on this issue, we need a whole army of you folks who have backgrounds in chemistry and backgrounds in physics and explosives to take on all of these other chores, because it seems like we've got a small handful of these scientists who are doing the work of an entire army.
Yeah, but as time goes on, Michael, I think we'll see that more people will be motivated, because as the economy fails and the wars expand and people's personal lives are directly affected by all of this, I think people will be compelled to help us find the truth. And we're taking very important steps here that help people who would do more typical research just kind of step in and verify and take the next step. And so these first papers are very important. But I think that you're exactly right. There were many of us many years ago, and before me, I think you were involved before I was, but people who knew, just looking at the buildings, that nothing falls through the path of most resistance. That's a very obvious sort of, you don't have to be a scientist to see that nothing will fall through the path of the most resistance.
Sure, it's almost like water flowing uphill.
Right, exactly. See, you know, you don't have to have a PhD to see that. You only have to have an open mind. You only have to be able to say, maybe what we're being told is not quite true. Maybe there's another alternative hypothesis or an alternative theory that explains the evidence better, and I think that there is, and I think we're seeing now that the evidence is becoming so strong that people would really have to be largely unconscious to not be able to admit that there's something more to the story of 9/11.
Now, what impact do you expect this new paper to have on the general public in accepting these hypotheses?
Well, I think that depends in some way. That depends on how many of us are willing to kind of do a few extra things, you know, say, okay, we've got these researchers that were able to publish several mainstream journal articles now, and that means that mainstream scientists have agreed to evaluate this evidence, have agreed that it's compelling, have agreed to publish it. So, you know, everyone else can say, well, certainly I know some people who are into science, I know some people who are in government, and I can take these papers and I can ask them to take a look at them. And I can say, you know, spend an hour a week or something just sending some messages, asking people to look at this evidence, maybe printing it out. You know, they're openly available. We go to a great extent to make sure that we use open access mainstream journals so that people everywhere can have access to them without having to pay, you know, $30 like typically researchers do. In this case, they're all free because we go to that extent. But people can print them out, they can photocopy them, they can send them to anybody they think might be interested, or, you know, someone who might take another step with it. So that's what we're hoping to see is people within the truth movement particularly helping us to promote these studies that we've done.
Yeah, I think that's important, and I hope folks will go out there, get copies of these important papers, and pass them around to people who you know or who are involved in scientific research or chemistry or physics or any of that, because I think that when you speak somebody's language, they're much more likely to listen to you, and if you can go in with this credible scientific research, anybody who has a background in science tend to give it more credibility and may actually look at it, whereas so many people just, they don't even want to look.
Right. It's a painful subject. And really, that, as I said years ago when I first spoke out, it's really not a chemistry or an engineering problem. It's really a psychology problem that we're facing, because so much of what we love and so much of what we trust is at risk if we, you know, if we open our minds and say, maybe there's more to this story, and I think that people need to investigate this further and independently. If we say that, then we have to question, well, how did we get this far without our universities and our government representatives and our businesses helping us to understand that right away, instead of kind of covering it up or moving on as quickly as they could. This is a very important subject for all of us, for our futures and the future of our children.
I agree 100%, and so much harm to our country, our Constitution, and our freedoms, as well as the destruction of our economy through printing money like it's going out of style, has all contributed to this state that we're in, and the things that we're looking at today are very serious issues, and I hope folks will get involved in this historic and important battle. Now, Kevin, before I let you go, I wonder if there's anything that you want to touch on that we didn't get to.
Well, one thing I like to speak about when given the chance, it really is not so much part of the 9/11 independent investigation, but it does go to the point of how much we care about what happened on 9/11, and that is I'd like people to remember the 9/11 first responders, and that many of them are sick and dying and continue to have trouble just paying their bills because of that. And I think that people should, if they have a few extra dollars, go to Feel Good Foundation, for example, or a number of other organizations, and try to help those people out, because when we needed somebody, you know, they were there. So we need to be there for them now. You know, the main point of the independent investigation of 9/11 is the point that more and more as time goes on, people need to live more truthfully. And, you know, there are a lot of things that we can get to the truth of that will help our lives, that will help our futures, but there's nothing more important than knowing what happened on 9/11 because of what 9/11, the official story of 9/11, was used for. And we can do so much good for ourselves if we just stop and try to take a closer look and try to consider that the government investigators may not have been telling us the truth, and consider how important that is.
That was chemist Kevin Ryan, 9/11 citizen researcher, speaking with Michael Walsey of the 9/11 Visibility Project. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We'll conclude the program with some excerpts from a recent deposition given by former FBI translator Sibel Edmonds last month in a case involving congressional candidates in Ohio, in which the challenger, Krikorian, accused the incumbent, Gene Schmidt, of taking money from the Turkish government to suppress knowledge of the 1915 Armenian genocide. Much of Edmonds' deposition focuses on the role of various Turkish entities in buying favor within the halls of the U.S. government. But this has a greater relevance in displaying systemic corruption and deception by officials toward the American people. Sibel Edmonds is a multilingual Turkish-American who was hired by the FBI as a translator a few days after 9/11. Edmonds was fired from her position at the FBI's Washington field office after she accused a colleague of being involved in espionage on behalf of the Turkish government and making other serious charges of security breaches, cover-ups, and intentional blocking of intelligence, which she contended presented a danger to the United States security. Since that time, court proceedings on her whistleblower claims have been blocked by the assertion of state secrets privilege. She has since founded the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition and was awarded the Penn Newman's Own First Amendment Award in recognition of her defense of free speech as it applies to the written word. This audio comes to us courtesy of Brad Blog. We join the deposition as Krikorian's lawyer asks her about her accusations of corruption and espionage against various current and former U.S. officials.
Now, on that website and this state secrets privileged gallery, it seems like you have photographs of various individuals, right?
Yes.
Is Dan Burton one of the people who's in the gallery?
His picture is there, yes.
Okay. Why is his picture there?
I can't discuss the details of those individuals' not legal activities in the United States, but those pictures, his and others, are there because state secrets privilege was mainly invoked to cover up those individuals' illegal, extremely illegal activities against the United States citizens who were involved in operations that were, again, against for the foreign governments and foreign entities, against the United States interest.
Okay. And Dan Burton is the representative, member of Congress from Indiana. Is that correct? Is that the right place?
I believe he is.
Okay. What about, it also appears that you have a photograph of Dennis Hastert in the gallery?
Yes.
Okay, and why is his photograph there?
Again, this information is public, has been public. Mm-hmm. It's, he would be one of the primary U.S. persons involved in operations and activities that are not legal. And they are not for the interest of the United States, but for the interest of foreign governments and foreign entities.
Okay. Yeah, and again, Mr. Hastert was the Speaker of the House and Representative from Illinois?
At the time, he was.
Can you tell me anything about what your concerns are about Mr. Hastert?
This information has been public. The concerns, again, would be in several categories. Acceptance of large sums of bribery in forms of cash or laundered cash and laundering it to make it look legal for his campaigns and also for his personal use in order to do certain favors and call for certain actions and make certain things happen for foreign entities and foreign governments' interests, the Turkish government's interests and Turkish business entities' interests.
Did you have reason to believe that Mr. Hastert, for example, killed one of the Armenian genocide resolutions in exchange for money from these Turkish organizations?
Yes, I do.
Are you aware of other members of Congress other than Mr. Hastert taking money from Turkish organizations in exchange for denying the Armenian genocide?
Yes, and not only taking monies but other activities too, including being blackmailed for various reasons.
Stephen Solars is on in your gallery as well. I believe he's a representative from New York. Is that correct? I'm really guessing.
He used to be.
Was. Right.
Correct. He is a registered lobbyist for the was a registered lobbyist for the government of Turkey.
Mr. Hastert is also a registered lobbyist for the government of Turkey now?
That's what I have read, and it was announced. Yes, he is. Okay.
And why is Mr. Solars in your gallery, if you can tell me? Bless you.
Bless you. Mr. Solars and certain others in that gallery, as lobbyists, they also acted as conduits to deliver or launder contribution and other bribes to certain members of Congress, but also in pressuring outside Congress, and including blackmail in certain members of Congress.
And Mr. Solars and others would be doing this on behalf of these Turkish organizations?
And the Turkish government, correct, both.
It looks like you have a photo of Bob Livingston on your gallery as well?
Yes.
And I believe he was a congressman from, I want to say, Louisiana at some point?
Correct. So,
he was the one that was going to be the speaker, but then left.
Yes.
Why is he in your gallery?
Until 1999, until he left, for activities that he was engaged, not very legal activities, on behalf of foreign interests and entities. And after 1999, acting as a conduit to, again, further foreign interests, both overtly and covertly, as a lobbyist, but also as an operative.
When you say as an operative, what do you mean by that?
In order to explain, I will give you an example, maybe. Is that okay?
Sure.
Just a hypothetical example? Or
it's okay with me. Yeah.
Okay. If an individual has companies set up and clients in offshore islands like Cayman Islands, for example, and is able to, as an operative, to launder money by foreign entities that were obtained illegally, and some of them had to do with narcotics, and use these Cayman Islands offshore accounts to do that, and then some of that money goes to the congressional people. I would call that not overt, I would call that covert operations, covert operative operations for that person, but rather than the classic lobbying operation.
One of the things that indicates in your biographical information is that you've made certain allegations. Some of them we've talked about a little bit, and I wanted to ask you about some of the others. One of the entries indicates nuclear secrets black market. It says Edmonds alleges that in the course of her work for the government, she found evidence that the FBI, State Department, and Pentagon had been infiltrated by a Turkish and Israeli-run intelligence network that paid high-ranking officials to steal nuclear weapon secrets. And they have some footnotes for that and some sites. Is that correct that you've made those allegations?
That information is correct. And if I were remaking it, I would say those are government organizations and others. There's another place missing there. They list the State Department, et cetera, but there's one other place that's missing.
And what is that place?
That would be RAND Corporation.
And can you tell me about the, give me some more information about the Turkish and Israeli-run intelligence network that is referred to there?
Again, this information has been public, without getting into any methods of intelligence gathering. Yes, through certain U.S. Officials, executively appointed officials, foreign entities, not necessarily or not only government-related, so if you say Israel and Turkey, not only government-related, but other entities, because it has multi-layers, their operations, and some of these layers, sometimes they conduct their operations independently and with the sole purpose of obtaining a profit. And therefore, the information they obtain, let's say the nuclear or weapons technology related information, doesn't necessarily only go to Turkey or Israel, but they sell it to the highest bidder. That's how they operate. They contact their people, whether it is in ISI, in Washington, D.C., part of the military attaché for Pakistani intelligence, or the certain Saudi business people in Detroit may be contacted. And they say, okay, and talk about these Turkish entities, we have obtained this particular DVD containing this, and this person is willing to pay $500,000, will you offer more? Because if you don't, we will give it to this person. So what I'm trying to say is they do it both for governments, foreign governments, but some of those operatives, they offer it in open market, and they have... they have individuals on their payroll on almost every major nuclear facility in the United States, RAND Corporation, and various, in Midwest, various Air Force labs that develop certain weapons technology, which I'm not very familiar with the technology itself.
When you refer to the And when the article refers to the paid high-ranking American officials, can you identify who they are?
That person has been identified by others. And he has been identified as the as Mr. Mark Grossman, who used to work for the State Department.
Well, Mr. Grossman, I think, is also in your gallery, correct?
Yes.
And I read somewhere that Mr. Grossman had some relationships with a Turkish organization, Turkish diplomats here in the United States.
Yes, he had very, very close relationship with not only Turkish diplomatic communities and entities, but business, and also some of these criminal layer operatives that I told you about. And currently that he's not working, he actually is working for a Turkish company called İhlas Holding.
Okay. Now, was Mr. Grossman the ambassador to Turkey at some point?
Yes.
Okay. And then what was his position at the State Department, if you recall?
He had several different positions. I believe in 1999 or 2000 was European Affairs that dealt a lot with NATO. And afterwards, during an early Bush administration's stage, he was the second or the third highest person in the State Department. I'm not sure about the title.
During that time, when he was the second or third highest-ranking person at State, I've read somewhere that you've alleged that he actually warned the Turkish embassy about a CIA front company that had been set up to stop proliferation of nuclear weapons.
That would be summer 2001, whatever title he held at that point. Mr. Grossman informed a certain Turkish diplomatic entity who was also an independent operative of a company called Brewster Jennings, because Brewster Jennings was frequenting the American Turkish Council as a consulting or analyst firm, and there were certain nuclear-related operatives who wanted to hire Brewster Jennings and have it pose as a front company. So there were talks between those Turkish operatives and Brewster Jennings, and Mr. Grossman wanted those people to be warned that Brewster Jennings was a government front for government, and it was a front, it was not a company, it was a front for government, U.S. government, and for those Turkish individuals to be told to stay away from Brewster Jennings. But the person who received that information, the Turkish diplomatic but also operative, actually contacted the Pakistani military attaché and discussed with the person who was there about this fact, and also told them, warned them to stay away from Brewster Jennings.
Now, one of the other entries indicates, it says 911 for knowledge, and I'll just read it. It says, she claims that the FBI received information in April 2001 from a reliable Iranian intelligence asset that Osama bin Laden was planning attacks on 4 to 5 cities with planes. Some of the people were already in the country, and the attacks would happen in a few months. Did you make that claim?
I took the language specialist, Farsi-speaking language specialist, the senior language specialist from the Iranian division, mm-hmm. Farsi division in FBI Washington field office, who worked right next to me, to the 9/11 Commission and Inspector General's office, and he testified on this. He informed me and he showed me this translator, Behruz Sarşar, and there's documents out there that he went to Inspector General's office. He gave them the documents, the translated documents on this Iranians. I was not part of that translation. I was not involved. After I left the FBI, because I was witness to that department's what they had obtained, I just facilitated Mr. Sarşar's meeting with 9/11 Commission.
We've talked about some members of Congress having connections with Turkish government or Turkish organizations. Are there others that you're aware of, other than the ones we've discussed?
Already? Congressional members?
Congressional members?
Yes.
Can you identify some of them?
Okay. Tom Lantis is one of them. I believe he passed away. And Tom Lantis's office would be not only with the bribe, but also in disclosing highest level protected U.S. intelligence and weapons technology information, both to Israel and to Turkey. His office was also involved with that. It was not only bribery, but it was other very serious criminal conduct. I believe Roy Blunt is there. There's an individual with a question mark there. The reason is a question mark is I was terminated by April 2002, but this particular congresswoman, the Turkish, these Turkish organizations and operatives, if they can't do it via money, they do via blackmail. So they collect information on sexual lives and other information like that. And this individual, this congresswoman, is married with children, grown children, but she is bisexual. So they had sent Turkish female agents, and that Turkish female agent worked for Turkish government, and had sexual relationship with this congresswoman in her townhouse, actually in this area. And the entire episodes of their sexual conduct was being filmed because the entire house, this congressional woman's house, was bugged. And so they had all that documented to be used for certain things that they wanted to request, but I left, so I don't know whether she, that congresswoman, complied and gave. That's why I couldn't use her name, her face, because I don't know if she did anything illegal afterwards. But
can you tell me how you know all that?
In general terms, when foreign targets among themselves discuss how they were going to achieve certain goals, objectives, and if those communications are collected and recorded.
And is this congresswoman still a sitting member of Congress?
Yes. I was trained as a language specialist by my agent to find pertinent information. And one of the things that we were taught in the FBI, everyone was taught in the counterintelligence, that the target U.S. persons, whether they are in Congress or executive branch or wherever, first go by foreign entities through what they refer to as hooking period. And it was very common, it's a very common way of trying to find vulnerabilities, and that is sexual, financial, any other kinds of greed, and it was done a lot. It was being done a lot. And in some cases, certain people from Pentagon would send a list of individuals with access to sensitive data, whether weapons technology or nuclear technology, and this information would include all their sexual preference, how much they owed on their homes, if they have gambling issues, and the State Department, high-level State Department person would provide it to these foreign operatives, and those foreign operatives then would go and hook those Pentagon people, whether they were at RAND or some other Air Force base, and then the hooking period would take sometimes 6 months, sometimes 1 year. They would ask for a small favor, but eventually, after they would do the targets, the U.S. person, some small favors, then they would go blackmail, and then that person would give them everything, nuclear-related information, weapons-related information. It always worked for them, so it was not always money.
If you know, I mean, what was it that the these Turkish entities wanted from this congresswoman?
I know for sure that Armenian genocide was one, because her husband was also involved, had some high-level position, not an elected person, with where she came from. And they had another representative who was making it possible, but supposedly she, at that point, was an obstacle. That's all I know.
In your experience, I mean, was this hooking technique used with other members of Congress by Turkish entities?
With regard to Mr. Hastert, for example, he used a townhouse that was not his residence, and for certain not very morally accepted activities. Now, whether that was being used as blackmail, I don't know. But the fact that foreign entities knew about this, in fact, they sometimes participated in some of those not maybe morally well activities in that particular townhouse that was supposed to be an office, not a house, residence.
With respect to that congresswoman, you said one of the things that they wanted was, you said Armenian genocide. I assume you were referring to the fact they wanted her support to oppose the Armenian genocide resolution.
Yes. And she was not leaning that way during that stage until this hooking started.
And does it surprise you that they would go to those lengths to gain her opposition to such a resolution?
No, not at all.
Well, why not?
It's a very important issue, and whether it's money, whether it's sexual blackmail, anything they would do to not let this happen or get the support so it wouldn't happen.
Why is Roy Blunt on in your gallery?
Be one of the individuals who was the recipients of both legally and illegally raised donations, campaign donations from foreign entities.
And what foreign entities?
The ones that I'm aware of, Turkish entities.
Yeah. I understand that you executed an affidavit, or a declaration actually, in this case on August 5, 2009. In paragraph 3 of your declaration, you say, I also obtained evidence that the government of Turkey had engaged in practices and policies that were inimical to American interests and had in fact resulted in both the direct and indirect loss of American lives. And do you recall saying that in your declaration?
Yes.
Can you tell me what practices and policies that you were referring to that were inimical to American interests?
From mid-1990s, at least until towards end of 2001, in Central Asia and Caucasus there. And these operations and practices included Islamization of the certain segments of those Turkic nations. Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, there are so many of them in that area, and setting up madrasas and bringing in, helping bringing, at the time they were not referred to as Al-Qaeda until 2001, September 11, they were referred to as plain Mujahideens from Afghanistan and Pakistan into Central Asia, then to Turkey to give them passports, and then funnel them in 1997, 1998 to certain Eastern European countries and the Balkans in order to counter Russia as far as the energy sources are concerned in those countries, whether it's oil or whether it's natural gas. And the best way to describe it is Cold War is not over. It's a continuation of Cold War over those nations. And what we did in Afghanistan in early 1980s with Mujahideen, we have been doing now in Central Asia by using Islam and extremism and these madrasas and Pakistani and Afghani elements to tilt certain stuff in terms of those resources to certain business interests here.
The people you've identified, the people that you've talked about today, you're certain about?
Yes.
You've been listening to excerpts of an August 8th deposition of former FBI language specialist and whistleblower Sabelle Edmonds. You can watch her entire 3-hour depo at bradblog.com. Thanks for listening to another episode of Unwelcome Guests. You can download MP3s of the show on the web at unwelcomeguests.org.
Spread it out.